Hello and welcome to Season 12, Episode 31 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Tuesday, the 5th of November, and it's the day that the UK celebrates the capture and torture of Guy Fawkes by blowing things up. In the show this week, we will be going over the news and the community news and some events. With me this week are the usual crew, my homies, Martin Wimpress.
Yo, yo, yo.
And Alan Pope.
Booyakasha.
Oh, lovely. Martin.
Hello.
What have you been up to recently?
I've been moonlighting on other podcasts and things.
Shocker.
Plural. Podcasts plural.
Yes.
I see. Now you've got a new job. You don't need us anymore.
I'm flavour of the month at the moment.
Yeah. So what have where have you been moonlighting and what have you been talking about?
Unsurprisingly, I've been talking about Linux and open source and Ubuntu, and I joined the Linux lads from Ireland, who we obviously have met at OggCamp in the past and Fostalk Live. So I joined them for a podcast recording a couple of weeks ago, and I was interviewed by Infinitely Galactic on YouTube.
Oh, what's that? I've not heard Infinitely Galactic.
The shorthand's IG, but his name's Blaine, and he's been doing videos about desktop Linux for donkey's years. He's based down in Tasmania.
Oh, cool.
So we had a good chat, and he broke that interview up into two parts, and it was really good speaking to him.
Is that because you couldn't shut up? You had to break into two.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. And then I went on a podcast with Brent from Jupiter Broadcasting on their Jupiter Extras podcast channel in a segment that's called Brunch with Brent. They put out the whole hour without cutting it in half, Alan.
And were you eating brunch while doing this?
It was a virtual lunch, yes. We did exchange notes about, you know, if we were having brunch, what would we have been eating, all that, you know, to get in the mood and everything. And he gave me a call on the phone 3 or 4 days beforehand, so we had a bit of a catch-up because we hadn't seen each other since Linux Fest Northwest. So sort of, you know, just reacquainted ourselves.
I guess we'll put links to those other podcasts and videos and stuff in the show notes, won't we?
Yeah, why not?
Excellent. Alan, what have you been doing with yourself?
I've been on holiday.
Ooh, where have you been?
I had a staycation at home. I didn't go anywhere. I just had a week off work while it was half term and the kids were off. We kind of mooched about. I got some jobs done. Garden is now tidy. The woodwork on the outside of the house is now painted. Got rid of a car that I needed to get rid of.
We won't ask why.
Yeah, there wasn't a body in it or anything. it's just been sat on the driveway, and it's a previous car that I needed to get rid of. So yeah, just doing some jobs, really, just pottering around the house, doing a few jobs. Oh, and I did a live stream on YouTube, which was fun, about Ubuntu.
What was that one?
Yeah, that was the one was about reporting bugs, which was too long. It went on for about an hour, but the people who I was talking to and said, oh yeah, do a live stream. So I did, and it was like an hour long, and I did another version which is 2 minutes long, which cuts out most of it. But people seem to want these kind of instructional type things that come from the horse's mouth, you know, just give you the facts of, you know, what you need to do to file bugs and contribute to Ubuntu. So probably do a few more of those. That was quite good fun.
So, Martin, what's first up in the community news this week?
Well, one of our colleagues, Galen, wrote on the Ubuntu blog announcing the roadmap for the official support for the Raspberry Pi 4 running Ubuntu.
Oh, excellent. We spoke last time, didn't we, about an initial release of Ubuntu 19.10 for the Raspberry Pi 4?
That's right.
So what's on the roadmap?
It working completely is one of the things that's on the roadmap.
Oh, oopsie. Are there problems with it at the moment then?
Yes. So there's three versions of the Raspberry Pi 4 with 1, 2, or 4 gigabytes of memory. And we've run into a bug where if you have the 4 gigabyte version and your Raspberry Pi uses more than 3 gigabytes of memory, all the USB ports stop working.
Oh, that's quite a big problem.
So that's being fixed. The fix will be out soon. And if you do have a 4 gig version and you want to work around that, there's a rather dirty workaround, which is just to limit the RAM to 3 gig, which you can do with a kernel parameter.
That's nasty.
Interesting. Is this something to do with the fact that with 4 gigs of RAM, you need 64 bits to access that much, don't you? So is it something to do with that?
This bug specifically exists in the AMD 64 version.
ARM 64.
ARM 64, goodness. Yes, thank you, Alan. So, and the work that's gone into preparing these 1910 images for the Raspberry Pi 4 will be backported to a later release of 1804, so probably around the time we do the next hardware enablement stack across the rest of the Ubuntu family, we'll bring Raspberry Pi support to 1804 as well.
Right. And does that mean that they'll be able to support Ubuntu Core on the Raspberry Pi 4 then once the LTS is supported?
Yes, yes. In fact, I didn't look to see what the status of Ubuntu Core is, but that will certainly be something that we support for 2004. I imagine those images may come out for 1804 when we do the hardware rev.
Mm.
Don't hold me to that. I'll find out. Let's report back on that one at a later date. But although these are, you know, pre-installed server images, as you can imagine, there are industrious people on the internet that have figured out there are meta packages for the various desktop environments that exist for the flavors. And lo and behold, now there's a whole glut of I'm running Ubuntu, I'm running Zubuntu, I'm running Ubuntu Mate and Kubuntu. You know, people are running up these desktop environments across the whole family using this image to sort of bootstrap things.
Cool. And will you be having an official Ubuntu Mate image for the Pi?
Yes, I will. I get asked this question daily on Twitter, many times a day on Twitter, and this has only amplified the rate at which that question has been arriving via DM.
Which is pretty reasonable, really, because your image for the Raspberry Pi, the previous iterations, was quite popular. So you can see why.
Yes, it is popular. Yeah, and I will make one. And the thing is that probably it's going to be close to Christmas now. We've got a busy spell at work. I'm going to be traveling again. So as we get close to Christmas, hopefully I'll have time to work on that and finish that.
What's up next, Alan?
The Debian project have a potential new homepage. It's a proposal, I think, but it's a bit of a change to the existing Debian.org homepage, which is, I think we could say, a bit plain.
Yeah. Lots of text.
There's a lot of text, links to news. And I think one of the pitfalls of Debian's web property, shall we say, is it's really not straightforward to navigate. If you just want to get the ISO image, it's surprisingly hard to get some of them. They've improved some of the navigation. It's a little bit easier, but it's not super friendly. But this new page actually isn't a tremendous improvement either.
Oh, gosh.
It's very Debian.
Yes. It's got an increase of at least, 100% of images on the page, although one of those images is the Debian logo and another one is a picture of lots of people. So there are now images on the front page, but it does look a bit dated, and it does. I don't know why this is. Is it just nobody steps up to do these things, or is the project resistant to having a modern-looking page? Or, you know, do they eschew modern things and actually It's, you know, good enough. So long as it works in Linux in a terminal, then, you know, it's good enough for me, John. I don't know. I don't know what the attitude is on there. I don't know. Do they have a web team? I don't know. It just does feel like they could just take a step further and make it a bit prettier, and make it, you know, responsive, look nice on a mobile device. Look, you know, because we know that a lot of people use mobile devices to browse the web, right? And it, while you might not be downloading an ISO image on your phone, but, you know, some of us weirdos do, it would be nice if it looked a bit prettier. Unfortunately, I'm not the person to do that because I'm not a web dev, but I don't know. It would be nice if someone stepped up and made it look pretty.
Yeah, it's probably lack of time and people that don't have interest in that particular thing within the Debian project.
Right.
They got more interested in, you know, the innards of, you know, a Linux operating system and harmonizing all of that stuff.
Mm. But no other Linux distribution that I can think of that's in the top, let's say, conservatively 10 mm-hmm. distros has a page that bad.
Mm. That's a fair point.
What one major improvement is this does have a big download button right there.
Yes, that is a much needed improvement.
I'll be interested to see how that pans out because, of course, you end up then downloading the version that doesn't have any firmware in it and then you struggle getting any sort of modern device to work reliably with Wi-Fi and what have you and some, you know, GPUs. Anyway, maybe this is an opportunity to put out a call for action. If you are a web developer and you would like to contribute to Debian because you're not, you know, a Linux systems engineer, then maybe you should contact the Debian project and find out how you could get involved.
I think probably step one would be create a mock-up prototype of what you think the homepage should look like, you know, rather than, you know, actually doing a pull request on the web page. Maybe do a mock-up and say, hey, how would someone like this kind of thing?
That sort of thing does work. When we were working on Ubuntu Mate Welcome in the very early days, Luke sent a mock-up in and I thought it was an actual design and I said that's brilliant, make that a thing. And he was like, oh, I don't know how to do any of that, I just drew a picture. And then he went silent for a couple of months and he came back and he'd worked how to do CSS and JavaScript and HTML and actually implement it.
Next up, Elementary has published some updates for October. Now, one of the big things here is a new utility for installing Flatpaks.
Yeah, they've got a new application called Sideload.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's not baked in at the moment, I guess, and maybe it will be in the future. But it means that when you browse to a page or a website that contains a Flatpak ref file, mm-hmm. that it knows what to do with that file. So that rather than you having to hunt around and download stuff on the command line and then, you know, using command line tools in order to install, you know, the application that you want, you can, in theory, just click on a thing and follow the prompts to get your software installed, which is, you know, as a user, that's your ultimate goal. Your ultimate goal is not open a terminal and type commands. It's, I want that piece of software installed. And so they're trying to make that easier.
That's a nice improvement as well, because connecting up, you know, Flatpak repositories is non-trivial at the command line.
Right. We've long lamented that adding a Flatpak repo to a system is very much like adding a PPA. You know, you type obscure commands that, you know, reference this external site and you're adding that to your system, and then you can, from that point onwards, you can then install the application that's on that host. And so this makes it possible for you to do that, but in a graphical environment.
This is not adding a Flatpak repo of their own just yet. This is giving you the facility to connect to existing Flatpak repositories and then install software from them.
Yep, exactly. So it pops up a little dialogue box, and I've seen some people have been a little bit upset by this, but it pops up a little dialogue box in order to warn the user, because as we've spoken about before, Elementary have a very strong opinion on the way applications should look and behave. And if you're adding a Flatpak repo, or indeed a snap or an app image, anything that's not gone through their App Center curation process, then it might not have the same design ethos, look and feel. Yeah, it might not fit on the elementary desktop quite as well. So they pop up this warning dialogue that says, you know, do you want to install this untrusted app? And gives you a few notes about the thing you're installing, which is a bit, it's interesting. One of them, it gives you a warning that the download size might be large, which is a good thing to tell you, you know, because you might be on a metered connection. So that's quite nice. It says updates to this app will not be reviewed, by which they mean it's not curated by the elementary team.
Doesn't go through their store review, you mean?
Yes.
Right.
And it says other apps from this distributor may appear in App Center. So you're basically, it's like adding a PPA, you know, you're adding that Flatpak repo. And so from that point onwards, if there are other applications in that repo, you will see those as uncurated apps in App Center.
And so that therefore implies that App Center now speaks Flatpak. So this tool is a means to connect to a Flatpak repository. And then once that's been done, those apps then appear in App Center.
Yeah, they're pushed down below everything else. There's like the section at the top, which is curated. And then the section below that is non-curated. And that includes stuff that's in the archive, the Ubuntu archive, and whatever Flatpak repositories you add. So they're sticking to their guns. They're totally, you know, this is exactly what the elementary guys are all about, is, you know, they'd way prefer people write native elementary applications and serve them up through App Center delivered via Debs currently and probably Flatpaks in the future. But people want to go off-piste and they want to install stuff that they need. And so this is making it easy for them to do that. So, yeah.
And does Sideload just do Flatpaks, or will it connect up PPAs, for example?
No, I think Sideload only does Flatpaks. I may be wrong, but I think that's the only reason it exists.
Alan, what have we got next?
There was a bug in Ubuntu. Whoopsie.
Oh, whoops.
Yeah. So there was a new feature that landed in 1910 that allowed you to share your media over the network. So your photos, music, video. I think we may have mentioned it a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about 1910. And unfortunately, in some circumstances, it was on by default. And that might be a problem if you're on a corporate network with your laptop full of photos and music and videos. Whoopsie. I thought it was off by default, but it looks like from the way I read the bug report, and Martin may be able to clarify this, from the way I read the bug report, if you're running something other than GNOME,
yeah,
then it would be on by default because it wasn't switched off or something like that.
Oh.
Yeah. I didn't look in detail, but I imagine this is an override we ship with Ubuntu proper for the GNOME settings to disable it by default. And if you're not running GNOME, you don't get that override and it's an on by default.
Yeah, I think one of the people who reported it was running Kubuntu. And the person who reported it, I mean, I laugh, but it's quite serious because, you know, who knows what was in your photos folder. It could have been, you know, absolutely anything, screenshots of stuff and, you know, actual photos, because most people, their photos are in their pictures directory for a lot of people. And there might be your music collection. There might be, you know, video files that you don't really want to share with other people. So I could see how this, you know, people were frustrated, but it looks like it was turned around pretty quick. It's just a shame that it slipped through, really.
And last up in the community news, Fedora 31 has been released along with all of the additions. Mm. And there's a preview of Fedora Core OS. That sounds like a bit of a throwback.
Yeah, it's a bit unfortunate. This is actually Core OS, which is now part of the, you know, Red Hat family.
Ah, right. Yes.
Oh, they bought Core OS, didn't they?
Well, they bought somebody else who bought Core OS. I forget, but...
Right. So Core OS is now Fedora branded.
Yes.
But they're having a renaming contest, I saw in the release notes. So it's not going to be called Core OS in the future. I think they're going to call it something else. But that's to follow in the future. But that's their designed for IoT and edge computing, much like Ubuntu Core is. So that's their equivalent of that.
So probably a good idea that they rename it.
Well, I don't know. It's consistent, if nothing else.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah. I suppose Fedora only considering renaming it because they used to be Fedora Core back in the day.
Yes.
And that would be confusing. Maybe they want something that's trademarkable. I don't know. But there's loads of other spins and labs and stuff as well.
Yeah, lots of different desktop environments available. And three different architectures, four different architectures, although i386 is no longer supported for the base system.
In line with most other distros in 2019.
Yeah.
So I saw my friend Wolfgang has pumped out a Fedora spin, which is his take on Mate with Compiz Reloaded. I think he uses Compiz Reloaded over the top. And I was reading through the release notes, and one of the editions is specifically for astronomers. So they don't just have like spins which are this desktop and that desktop. They have spins which are for pursuits, and I thought that was fascinating. I was like, oh, that's quite a good idea.
It's a bit like Ubuntu Studio, really, because Ubuntu Studio is XFCE, but with a bundle of applications and Jack and, you know, a special kernel and that kind of stuff. It's not a lot different than that, but we don't tend to do those. We don't tend to have use case specific ISO images. I think the amount of QA that has to go on to test all of those, it just fills me with dread. So I'm kind of quite glad we don't do that.
Ubuntu did have sort of niche interest distros. There was Edubuntu and Mythbuntu, which are no longer being maintained. And as you say, Ubuntu Studio got rebooted again, 18 months or so ago. I quite like the idea, though.
Yeah, I like it, but I worry that it's yet more ISO images to build and yet more ISO images to maintain. If it's coming out on a particular day, that's a lot of work to do on release day for someone when you think about how much work they already do.
Those are wise words when it's 4 o'clock in the morning on release day and you've just had to do one last spin of everything.
Yeah, and you wonder where all the astronomers are. They're outside. They're not testing these ISOs. That's what...
Right. And finally, we have time for an event. Guadec 2020 and 2021 have been announced. They are going to be in Mexico and Latvia, respectively, and we'll have a link in the show notes to find out more. And now it's time for some news. News us up, Martin.
Okay, so as we record this... Earlier today, Microsoft have announced that their new Edge browser is coming to Linux.
Ooh.
Yay.
So they announced some time ago they were rebuilding Edge based on, Blink and Chromium and all the rest of it, and they're now significant contributors to the Chromium open source project. So they've announced today at their Ignite conference in Orlando that they've got a release candidate available today for macOS. They've had Android and iOS versions for some time. Obviously, all the Windows things are taken care of. But then they had Linux on a slide. And I watched the part of the presentation about the Linux bit. And their words were, Linux is coming at a later time. And then right at the back of the auditorium was a solitary woo. And it felt very awkward because I think they were expecting a round of applause and it just didn't come. So I felt a bit sorry for them.
Oh,
is that one person representing like the 1% of people who run Linux? Like they thought they'd get one in the room. Everyone, I mean, it's a Microsoft conference. You've got to think that the vast majority of the people in the room don't care.
Indeed.
I assume that this is probably aimed at web developers who are working on Linux, and therefore it means that they can test on basically all the browsers except for Safari, but no one uses that.
I mean, that's certainly an advantage. I mean... The two of you, let's imagine this thing becomes available like next year. What would you use it? Would you choose to use it over Firefox or Chromium or Google Chrome?
No, I would use it for testing.
I almost certainly wouldn't use it over Firefox because I like how I've now got my Firefox set up. But that said, I do have Chrome installed for certain specific use cases where Chrome is better than Firefox. And if Edge had an edge on certain websites or applications until Firefox caught up, I might use that. If there was a particular, I don't know, maybe it was super good at
G Suite.
Unlikely. Well, no, but I'm thinking like if it had a really good 3D rendering pipeline, or, you know, it was just a really good ad blocker or something, then yeah, maybe I might use it, but it wouldn't be my primary browser.
Yeah, I could see me using this. So I have Firefox is my main browser, and I have Chromium for occasionally a website is weird, you know, or something's misbehaving with like privacy blockers and things, and I use Chromium to like check that the site actually works or whatever it might be. I could see me potentially using Edge for that, because, and this is an amazing statement to make, I'm coming to the point where I think I would trust a Microsoft published browser more than a Google published browser, albeit Chromium.
Huh. That is an interesting point. Yes. I wonder what our listeners would feel about this, and I would be interested to hear from people whether they would use a Microsoft Edge browser on Linux for whatever reason. Let us know. Laura will tell you how later.
What's up next, Alan?
Deezer have announced Splitter.
Okay, who's Deezer and what's a Splitter?
Sounds painful.
Deezer are a music streaming service, and they've made an open source product called Splitter. I say product, it's a bunch of stuff in a repository. It's mostly Python. It's all command line. It's not an application. It's all command line-y stuff. But what it does is it uses TensorFlow to split out vocals from a piece of music. So you give it a song, like any old song, and it will do magic, I don't know, machine learning or whatever the thing is, and split the vocals out from the music.
So is this like in Audacity, there's like a karaoke mode which will like analyze it and remove the vocals from the track, and you just have the music with a bit of echoey ghost vocals?
This is like that, but there's probably fewer ghost vocals in it. There's a tiny bit of that. I installed it on my laptop, and I ran it against a bunch of Queen songs and a couple of David Bowie tracks, and it's got multiple modes. One where you can just split vocal from everything else, but it's got another mode where you can split multi-track, and you can have one track vocal, one track percussion, one for bass, one for piano, and one for other. And I did that and split a track five ways, and then loaded all five tracks into Audacity, hit play, and it plays like normal, obviously, because they're all in sync with each other. But then individually, you can turn off tracks, and you could just turn off the percussion or turn off the vocal or turn off the bass line. And it sounds completely different, obviously. But it's super fascinating. I thought it was really interesting. And I showed it to my daughter, who's doing music GCSE. And she was like, oh, my God, I need this. I need this to be able to, you know, create little remixes and some of the compositions she has to do. This would be very useful for her.
You shared some clips with us earlier. I've got a couple of questions about this. The first was, I thought it would be really good if you're wanting to learn a drum part for a song. It actually pulls the drums out really quite clearly, enough that you could reproduce that yourself and, you know, learn the drum part. And the bass as well was particularly clear and really great for pulling out, you know, the bass part if you wanted to learn it. You said this uses TensorFlow.
Mm.
So does this mean it was using your NVIDIA GPU on your laptop to do this?
I happen to be using it in CPU mode, but it's 100 times faster if you use the GPU.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think it took about a third to a half of the duration of the song in order to split the song out. I think it took a bit longer if you split five ways. But I would imagine it would just take a few seconds if it used the GPU.
I might have to have an experiment, and I'd be interested to see if you use the GPU, if it's more accurate and the resulting audio that you get out of it is, you know, closer to the original.
I don't know. I mean, bear in mind, I'm feeding it compressed MP3 files.
Ah, fair.
If I ripped a WAV directly off a CD or if I got high quality flax or something from some source somewhere, then it may be that it's better. But I'm feeding it like commercial grade MP3s. The thing I thought was interesting was actually the instructions on the README were pretty straightforward for me to install. I had to install Anaconda and then clone the repository and run a couple of Conda commands, and that was it. I was done, and it gave me a sample command line, and I just feed it an MP3 and out pops an output directory. And then I got excited and I just pointed it at an entire folder full of MP3s. And I thought, no, don't be silly, Alan. You don't need your house that warm. So, yeah, I stopped it and I just did a few individual tracks.
I'll tell you one thing I found really interesting is one of the songs you sent us had quite a lot of echo on the vocals, and it separated out the vocal track, including that echo. Whereas when you do the equivalent with other tools I've seen for doing the same sort of thing, because of the way it does it, the echo tends to be what gets left behind. So it's really interesting to see how well this can identify what's part of the voice rather than what's part of the music. And it obviously does it in a very different way.
Yeah, they've taught some machine learning thing. And when you run the command, you download, I think, whatever the output of that training that has happened. And I imagine you could probably retrain it yourself somehow, but I haven't looked into that. I've just been consuming it. And, in 10 minutes, I got it up and running, and it was, quite good fun. So worth a look.
Brilliant.
And last in the news with this week, GitLab is considering banning support staff from some regions.
Mm. What does that mean?
So this is an actual existing staff they have that they're considering banning from their company, but they're considering not hiring or not allowing staff who move to certain countries to have access to sensitive data, basically.
So there's a few things that are interesting about this. One, is that they're doing this entire conversation in the open on a GitLab issue, which I thought was fascinating, because this felt like internal company drama that I should not be seeing. It really felt like someone had done a paste bin of an internal email thread and I was reading it. But GitLab are all about openness. So, well done to them for doing this in the open, because it's all completely transparent. That does mean they're getting a lot of flack, and they've had our good friend and previous Canonical employee, David Planella, who's their community manager, has a few hours ago, as we record this, switched off comments on that issue. But the point of this is GitLab have a potential customer, and that customer has requested that people who live in specific countries, and I think the original list was Ukraine, Russia, and China, but I think they've removed Ukraine from the list, and it's now Russia and China. Support operatives in those countries who work for GitLab must not have access to this potential new customer's data. So if you're a support person and you're trying to fix their GitLab instance, for example, you shouldn't have access to that stuff. And as you'd expect, a sysadmin or support person is likely to have that kind of access, but they want to ban certain people who live in certain countries from having that access.
I assume this potential customer is unknown.
People have speculated whether it's military or government or something, or just wildly paranoid. Wildly is overdoing it, but paranoid. They've said that the worry is that people who live in those countries may be kind of got at by the security services in those countries and influence them to do things that, for some reason, they don't seem to think that that would happen to those nationals if they lived in another country.
And they don't seem to think that the same thing might happen in a country such as the US or the UK.
The other interesting thing is the conversation on this thing is between internal employees at senior level. And one of them is the, what's her name? Candice. She's a global compliance director or something at GitLab. And she pointed out, if you're worried about hacking, the five top countries are, and then lists the countries, including the US. If you're worried about that, then, these are the countries you should be worried about, not those. But I don't think they're worried about hackers as such, like people who sit in Romania or Bulgaria or one of these countries and are hacking, to try and get get Bitcoin out of you or whatever. They're really worried about the state actors, I think. But it's a fascinating conversation. It's worth a look.
And the interesting thing about it happening in the open is, you know, you can bet if it's happening at GitLab in the open, it's happening all over the place behind closed doors, people asking for this sort of thing.
Yeah, I did wonder. I thought, you know, I know we've got support people at Canonical. I have no clue how that works because it's an opaque black box to me. It's another part of the organization. And I have no idea what happens there and whether we've been asked. But I don't know if we have the same responsibility because I don't think we host stuff for customers, but probably, you know, whether we would have access to that customer system on their site, you know.
Well, we operate clouds for customers, don't we?
Right. But I mean, I don't want to make this about us, but I think because I just don't know the answer to the question is the answer. But you're right, Mark. This almost certainly happens at Microsoft for GitHub and almost certainly happens at every other code hosting and place where they're storing customer data. You know, it's fascinating insight. I just hadn't even thought about that as a consideration as an enterprise.
We know you've got a Facebook account, so stop sharing cat photos for a moment and like or share our posts so your friends and family can find the Ubuntu podcast.
And that's all for episode 31. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week to discuss why distro hoppers are the worst. And next week will be my last show of the year.
Oh.
Because I'm going on paternity leave.
Yay.
Not that I get paid to do this anyway, but, you know, I'm taking a break to focus on my upcoming long-term support release.
Oh, very good. Yes. Well, you know, you'll be sorely missed, but it's as good a reason as any to leave a podcast, I suppose.
I'll probably be back next year.
Let's hope so.
Well, we don't know. We haven't had curry yet, Mark. We don't know if any of us are going to be back yet next year.
No.
But yes, I want to thank you for being here for so long. I know this is not goodbye, it's mañana, but I just wanted to thank you and for all your contributions to the podcast over the years and wish you well with your long-term support release that's coming. Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been lovely, Mark. Thank you.
Ah, well, yes. If you want to come and talk to us in between shows, you can email show@ubuntupodcast.org or come join our Telegram channel at ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. And we're at Ubuntu Podcast on Twitter. And you can come and see us on YouTube and leave us nasty comments at youtube.com/ubuntupodcast.